my paper is very much on the moral economy side of things this morning, which probably befits the sort of project that I'm working on at the moment. This is an ESRC-funded project called Rethinking the Market. And one of the things that I'm really trying to do in that project is to understand markets as sets of practices and to understand how particular types of economics theory actually obscures a number of practices that take place within markets. The ability of economists almost routinely now to ascribe a single set of behavioural characteristics onto the market environment and to assume that all of us at all times obey those single fundamental characteristics. What I want to do in this project more generally is to think of markets as contested behavioural spaces, spaces which might have an implied logic working in one direction, but also open up these moments in which it's possible to corrupt the pristine nature of the market. And corrupting the pristine nature of the market might be through the development of deliberately fraudulent practices. It might also be through the development of more politically progressive practices as well. So I hold open the idea that contestation of market norms can be a good and a bad thing at the same time. Now, as I've done no empirical work on fraudulent practices, I have promised you that I'll try to keep it as relevant as possible, but please do forgive me if I disappear off one of my abstract avenues at any moment. What I want to focus on in particular, I think, is the distinction between moral economy and economics proper, and I think that distinction can be understood in a particular way. It's about what can be seen in the world and what behaviour that exists in the world can be treated as seeable. And I think moral economy gives us a completely different set of starting points to observe behaviour that takes place within the world compared to economics proper. Economics proper is about bringing particular behavioural characteristics to the fore to render them visible in action. But of course, by rendering particular behavioural characteristics visible, at the same time it also renders other behavioural characteristics increasingly invisible. So I'm interested more in what economics renders invisible than what it renders visible. Let me try to explain through use of this particular diagram, or the next one that's coming up in a minute, what I'm trying to drive up here. And this takes the form of a quiz question. The quiz question is, which is the odd one out? And of course, it's one of those horrible quiz questions where the answer is, there isn't an odd one. That all four of these pictures are doing exactly the same thing, but they just do it in different ways. Okay, three do it in the same way, one does it in a different way. So one maybe is an odd one out there, and no prizes for guessing that it's this one down in the bottom right-hand corner. These are all four visual depictions of a market. I even included one with the word market in it, so I can really drive home the point that this is what's going on here. So the first three, I think, give us an everyday conception of what a market is. We don't actually know what those people are doing at any given moment of time. We can capture them in the practice of doing something, but we don't know exactly what it is, and we certainly don't know what motivates it. People come to actual marketplaces for a whole variety of different reasons. They come to buy, they come to sell, they come to browse, they come to meet their friends. They come to learn the embedded codes of practices that operate within that defined economic space. They might also come to learn how to corrupt those embedded codes of practice as well. We simply don't know from the first three slides exactly what people are doing, but we have this sense that they're doing something. Now, the fourth one becomes interesting in this respect because this is a purely formal characterization of what happens within a market. This, as I'm sure I don't need to tell you at all, is the economics depiction of a fully functioning equilibrium-oriented options market. And if you're able to derive something that's as clear and as crisply argued as this, there's a Nobel Prize in it for you. Or there certainly was for Black, Merton and Scholes, who developed this way of thinking about options markets. Now, the difference between these slides, I think, is that we have this sense that people are doing something in the first three, but we don't know what it is that they're doing. The people themselves are rendered completely invisible in the fourth corner here, but there is an inbuilt sense of what it is that they are doing. They are simply maximising in their behaviour. So the whole mathematical expression of what a market is couched very much in terms of this one behavioural characteristic of maximisation. Now I wanted to repeat this exercise and do exactly the same for the word economy. And something interesting happened. I couldn't really find any visual representations of the economy which captured this sense of people doing something. And this taught me something quite interesting. The move towards more and more abstract accounts of what the economy is. In all of the depictions that I could find, the economy was being presented as something that's knowable through its own aggregation. So we can tell how big it is, we can tell how well it's working, we can put figures on all of these things, but we don't ever have this visualization technique that helps us to capture what an economy is through looking at people doing things. So these are the least abstract accounts of what an economy is. And now, of course, I'm sure you're already aware there's going to be another thing popping up in this column in a moment, which mirrors the Black-Scholes-Merton equation. And of course, if I'm looking for a purely formalist economics account of what the economy is, then there's only one thing that I can show you, isn't there? And here it is. This is the two-dimensional representation delivered by the archpriest of formalist economics, Gerard de Breuer, to capture what an economy is. And the economy in this sense is derived in the following way. It studies the implications of combining convex set theory plus the mathematics of topographical surfaces, and it all echoes Kenneth Arrow's separating hyperplane theorem. Well, obviously, what else could an economy be other than that? And for those of you that like your obtuse diagrammatical representations delivered in equally obtuse words, I can satisfy your preferences as well, because that's how he describes what an economy actually is. Have a quick look at that while I'm continuing to talk to see just how far it takes us from any sense of being able to visualise people actually doing things, sets of practices that are encoded within our economic activity. And these depictions, I think, take me to the heart of my paper. I'm interested in broad terms in the mental patternings that exist in the heads of economists when they imagine both what a market is and what an economy is. It's a deceptively simple question to ask, what is an economy? And it's a deceptively difficult one to try to answer. Certainly when we look for the way that other people, in particular economists, have answered this question, it sheds very, very little light on that question. What it is that economists typically bring to mind when asking themselves what the economy is tends to be represented mathematically in purely formalistic terms. It's a thought process, a thought experiment in Kuhnian terms, rather than any solidly grounded empirical set of observations about what happens in those things that we associate with the economy. So what sorts of behaviour can be seen in the world as quintessentially economic behaviour is the question that I ask of classic texts in economics when I go about reading them. And what scope also does this provide for moral critique? If there are only certain things that count as economic behaviour, what happens to those things that don't count? And what happens to our ability to challenge those sets of practices if they're not even seen as economic behaviour in the first place? Now, this isn't a particularly well reflected upon question in the history of economic thought, but I don't think it makes it any less important for that. The range of possible economic experiences captured by economics clearly reflects whatever limits the subject field places through its own sense of self on what the economy in general terms might be thought to be. And I ask this question for today's purposes to say something about moral economy and how it might be possible to use various moral economy traditions to say things that could be of interest for those of you that study fraudulent economic practices in empirical terms. So how has it come to pass that for several generations now, moral economy has not been considered to be a part of economics itself? Now this might be a good thing for people like me because it gives us this slightly strange post-disciplinary homelessness through which we can appeal to moral economy traditions without feeling overtly constrained by having to do that in relation to economics proper. So this is what I have running through the back of my mind at this very, very early stage of drafting this paper. I think there are two different answers that run through the broad history of economic thought to the question of what the economy is. I think this is the more interesting of those two answers. Almost forget the pictures on this slide. It's the important thing is what I've written in this box here. Economy understood as a set of practices where there's no a priori assertions as to what those practices have to do. So there might be multiple moralities underpinning multiple types of economic behaviour. The economy is inherently contested through this view. Now the other view is this one, of the economy understood as a logic of order, where we can think in terms of purely logical predicates as to how all behaviour must take place within a functioning economic system for it to warrant the term economy of science. So these are the two starting points that I think I can read into the history of economic ideas. Economy understood as a set of practices on one hand, economy understood as a logic of order on the other hand. And there's some very interesting tensions that rise and fall within the history of economic ideas if you begin to think in this way. Now the account that hopefully in due course I'll be able to produce of what happened to moral economy in all of this is hopefully still original one, especially as it relates to fraudulent practices. But I can make no claim to precedence when competing meanings at the very word economy are identified. There are some very much more important people than me who have talked about this for quite some time. Here's one place where it might start. Polanyi and his conception of the economistic fallacy. The notion of the economistic fallacy tries to capture this curious double meaning of the word economy. Economy is that thing out there that we experience in everyday life. Economy is a particular type of behaviour, economising behaviour. Now, Polanyi said that within economics, there was this economistic fallacy whereby there was an artificial conflation of all economic possibilities with those that reflect the prevalence of a pristine market form undisturbed by attempts to corrupt its very essence. He was worried by the way in which economics was increasingly aligning itself behind one of the two meanings of economy, behind the economising meaning of economy. So the ability to enforce this notion of a particular type of behaviour as capturing all economic practices. That if the behaviour was beyond the economising frame, then somehow it was less economic and it would be studied by other people. So one of the things that Polanyi is railing against when talking about the economistic fallacy is the notion of economics as some sort of separate social scientific endeavour. The notion of economics as something that stands on its own and that has its own realm of activity which only it can talk about. Now it's not entirely clear from Polanyi's work in The Great Transformation about exactly who he's aiming these comments at. But I don't think it takes a great deal to unpack the references that appear in The Great Transformation, place them within the temp of the times, and come up with an answer on his behalf. And the answer that I come up anyway is this character. I think that Polanyi is trying to engage himself with the work of Lyman Robbins. And what at that time was the increasingly popular Robbins definition of economics. Robbins defined economics in 1932, and I quote, as the science which studies human behaviour as a relationship between ends and scarce means which have alternative uses. And it's through that definition that maximising activities get propelled onto some sort of pedestal as the only thing that is visible as the logic of order through which economics takes place. Just as an aside, when I first learned economics at school back in the 1980s when I was studying for my own levels, the Robbins definition appeared on page one of the textbook that was used at school. It didn't tell me that it was the Robbins definition, it just said that this is what economists do. So even 50 years later, the definition, even if Robbins' work in general had been increasingly bypassed by that time, the definition had stuck. And the definition was transferred down through future generations, through textbook learning, as that thing that economics was able to allow you to study. So I went for years and years and years not knowing that what I was always told economics was, was a particular definition drawn from Rawlings. And I think that this in itself, however much a purely personal anecdote from schoolhood can be emblematic of anything broader than that, I think that this does actually capture the sense in which the progressive teaching down the generations of economics does align around this one particular behavioural aspect, this one particular behavioural moment. Everything else seems to disappear. Robbins was the first person to emphasise scarcity in the definition of economics, and therefore to eliminate everything other than pure economising behaviour from what economists should be looking to study. But how do you understand fraudulent practices in Robbins' terms then? Anything that confronts scarcity constraints is economic, according to Robbins. It can be studied through economists' conception of a particular logic of order. But of course, fraudulent economic practices can confront scarcity in exactly the same way as non-fraudulent economic activities can confront scarcity. So fraudulent economic behaviour can be within the realm of economics, according to the Robbins definition, but only if it copies that particular pattern of behavioural types that allows it to be understood as economising behaviour in the first place. And of course, for Robbins, it's only this that counts as economic activity. Everything else can't be seen from within economics. Anything else can't be argued for or can't be argued against from within the realm of economics. It must be left to others. And presumably there are lots of those others congregated in the room this morning. The only thing you can do with Robbins' conception of economics is to ascertain the degree to which any type of economic behaviour, whether it's fraudulent or not, conforms to the standard economic puzzle of maximisation. Now, when it's fully fleshed out, the paper will contrast two originating moments within the history of economic thought to show just how distinctive the Robbins conception is. And these are the two originating moments that I'm hoping to focus on. The first will be the birth of economics in its modern form, when theoretical abstraction was first given equal billing to descriptive accounts of policy alternatives. And this is what I understand Adam Smith to have been doing. Smith is just representative here. He stands at the heart of a tradition that was increasingly being challenged but still retained its significance within economics for at least 100 years. But the second will be what might be considered in analogous terms at the birth of economics in its ultra-modern form. This is what I associate with Robbins. When every element of the economy's underlying visualisation technique for the economy was subjugated to the single behavioural aspect of economising. Now, I'm pretty sure that I'll be able to argue that in its modern form, i.e. its Smithian form, a thoroughgoing tension ran right through the heart of economists' self-understanding of what they were attempting to do. I like that tension. I think it's something that offers opportunities for all social science scholars still today. The tension might be thought of through the lens of John Neville Keynes's distinction between the art and the science of the economist's craft. Now, I'm trying to be more specific in this paper, though, so I've chosen to represent it as the tension between two things. You'll know what it is by now, because I've already been fighting them up. Firstly, thinking of economy as a set of practices embedded in their own social, political, cultural, and moral environments. Now, these practices are produced into subjectively, they're reproduced into subjectively, they're written into people's behavioural ambit into subjectively, and they're overwritten into subjectively as well. They evolve, and they become part of our lived experiences in line with the co-evolution of the social contract between the individual and the state. These practices, all economic practices, are far from pre-given. They don't exist in any pristine state. They are produced through action, and they're produced through constant action. So that's the first element that I take from the Smithian tradition of economics, what I've called here, and probably wrongly, the modern form of economics. Now the second one is thinking of economy as a logic of order, in which a single way of being becomes imprinted in the increasingly mathematised expressions of what the economy is. The mathematical notation might hide the fact on first glance, but both the Black-Scholes-Merton equation and the De Broglie stipulation that I have down in this corner on previous slides, allow only one type of economic behaviour. Guess what? It's consistent with Robbins's definition of what economics is. Now, the important thing for me, looking backwards in time to some of the earliest accounts of economics, is that there's no reason why these two things add up to a coherent whole. You do have a study of a set of practices on one hand and of a logic of order on the other hand, but there's no necessary reason why these two things go together to form any type of consistent or coherent social existence. Now, one of the most interesting historiographical accounts about Smith's Wealth of Nations was the apparent delay in its publication. Smith set off for London in some sort of stagecoach, I presume, from Edinburgh, 3.5 years before The Wealth of Nations was eventually published, with a full manuscript sitting in the stagecoach alongside him. When he got to London, however, he was increasingly, or all the biographical details suggest, he became increasingly worried about the nature of economic life that he saw around him. So the free-thinking professor squirreled away in Kirkcaldy, looking out onto the Firth of Forth, had one notion of what a pristine set of economic conditions might be. When he found himself in London, looking at the way that corporate interests were able to get reflected within government behaviour, he decided that there was something very, very different going on to his very clear-cut and thoroughly abstract notion of the logic of order. And he delayed writing. He delayed writing The Wealth of Nations, or publishing it, for another 3 years. And there's an extra layer of commentary that was added in that intervening period. A change of voice is what most of his... A change of voice is what most of the literary theorists who have worked on Smith's Wealth of Nations have come to identify within it. He increasingly left behind a rhetorical scheme based on his own system of natural liberty to play the role of policy advocates on a case-by-case basis to try to bring the constitution of modern economic man back into line with morally proper market-based behaviour. His grand scheme was this: for the production of wealth to be aligned to the production of citizens worthy of that wealth. And the delay in the publication of The Wealth of Nations was driven by the fact that in looking at the way the economic life was being conducted in modern-day London, he failed to see citizens that were worthy of the wealth that was being produced by the economy. So there is this moral economy tradition that runs all the way through the history of economic thought until Robbins. And it was Robbins who was able to bury in amongst all the notions of maximum thinking. It was Robbins who was able to bury Smith's creative tension. In conclusion, though, according to Geoffrey Hodgson, the Robbins definition gives us the economics of nowhere. It is a thought experiment that can't be lived. It's a thought experiment that we cannot ever see, except in our mind's eye, as a thoroughly worked out logic of order. It's not something that we can see in the economy itself. The economy always retains this emphasis on sets of practices. So if Hodgson can tell us that the Robbins definition leads to the economics of nowhere, the assumption must be that the countervailing economics of somewhere is still available. And the economics of somewhere must be that that focuses once again on sets of practices. And I think we can use the moral economy tradition to unpack lots and lots of different sets of practices. The Robbins definition, unfortunately, cannot lead to an economics of a particular time and place, because it doesn't allow acting individuals to be morally constituted by the influence of the surrounding behavioural environment. And we can be morally constituted by the effects of the surrounding behavioural environment for either good or bad. Doesn't necessarily mean that we will all take those behavioural cues in the same way and act upon them in the same way. The sorts of incentives that we read into our engagement with everyday economic life will differ from person to person. Fraudulent economic practices, from a Robbins perspective, however, cannot be a standalone empirical category. They cannot be understood in their own right and given their own logic and reason. They have to be understood through the overlay of the logic and reason of maximising principles. So the Robbins definition provides an economy which is stripped of Smith's tension, but I see nothing other than creativity within that tension. And so I would be a big advocate of trying to bring that tension back into play. It's a tension, I think, that is creative in intellectual terms. It allows us to see lots of different sets of economic practices and to try to understand them in their own given terms, rather than imposing some sort of template upon them. And it also might be creative in political terms. It allows us to think once again that things might be different and to make a series of political interventions in the hope of bringing those differences to bear. And that's where I'll stop. Thanks very much.